Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. You get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night, knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Every hobby or passion will shape the way you see the place you live. Cyclists will know the wiggle through San Francisco, runners the nearest trails or track, birders have their secret spots. But it may be that skateboarders have the most intimate connection to the city, or so Jose Body argues in his new book, Chipped. Because it's skateboarders who know and love the forgotten places. Under the BART, behind the school, down by the freeway, and they reimagine those places with their boards and their cameras. So today, Body will give us a skater's view of the city and our times. That's all coming up next, after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. I want to start with a place known to skaters all over the Bay Area, but perhaps less well known among civilians, among whom I count myself. It is the Rockridge Curbs, that bit of BART parking lot that's turned into a tiny carnival nearly every day by a variety of skaters working on their tricks. It's an extremely beautiful place as far as infrastructural underbellies go, with big concrete pillars arching skyward and Market Hall right there if you ever need a snack. But I've never had any idea why this particular place was so magnetic for skaters until I read Jose Body's new book of essays, Chipped. He's with us to fill us in on the skater's eye view of the city. Thanks so much for joining us, Jose.
Thanks for having me.
So why do skaters love the Rockridge Curbs?
I think skaters in general love parking lots and curbs. You know, I mean, curbs are very much our initial barrier. Learning how to ollie up and down curbs is kind of, a rite of passage. So, you know, some people think skaters need skate parks. Other skaters think we need parking lots. And I think just this big space and the ability to push from side to end to end, mm-hmm. With low impact obstacles in a fairly welcoming place close to public transit, it's pretty solid.
Is it partially just the community that developed there?
Absolutely. You know, the community that developed there was very much this kind of come one, come all United Nations, while still respecting the spot, respecting folks who park there to go to work. But when the pandemic hit, it kind of became this zone where parents use it to do, you know, meetings, you know, with other parents and coffee breaks and teach their kids how to learn, you know, how to ride a bike and people driving AV cars, you know, like remote control. So it kind of became this one-stop shop for just outdoor activity in the pandemic, which is what I write a lot about in Chipped.
And so for you, you learned a kind of new type of trick. I mean, I guess you've done it before. It's called a slappy.
Yeah.
So what is a slappy?
Oh, a slappy is very much a I don't want to say an old school trick, but a trick that started in the late 80s in Whittier, California, thanks to John Lucero, who, after getting kicked out of a skate park outside in the parking lot, started trying to replicate those tricks on the parking blocks, you know, against which the tires of a car are. Uh-huh. And that became the slappy, where you bash into a curb versus jumping into it, ollieing into it, with your front truck hitting the curb first and your back truck following. It kind of took new heights here in San Francisco, thanks to Danny Sargent, who at the Safeway on Church Street, those curbs over there, rest in peace to those curbs, he really kind of introduced slappies to the world and documented through Thrasher. But at Rockridge, with the curbs there, you can very much do a bunch of slappies in a row, and it's kind of like muscling into a trick versus popping into one.
Do you feel like you have just like a map in your head of all the places in the Bay Area that you have skated, would like to skate? Like, how detailed is that map?
It's an ever-growing map. Think of it like a Google map with a bunch of pins that just kind of gets recycled anew every day. And you know, has different generations, right? Even some of the previous skate spots in San Francisco, like, say, Brown Marble Benches, which was over towards Embarcadero, those ledges are now in play at the Waller Street kind of DIY skate park. So even some of the obstacles are intergenerational objects that persist in skateboarding history here in the Bay Area. But yeah, I think a lot of skaters have, if you name a city, they can probably tell you what spots are there.
Yeah. We're talking with Jose Body about his new essay collection, Chipped, Writing from a Skateboarder's Lens. You know, skateboarding's really allowed Body to explore these public spaces that we often ignore. And we're curious, like, is there a public space that people may not notice, but that you do? Because your sport, your hobby, your art, your job, and you've paid particular attention to it. We'd love to hear about those. You can send them to us at forum@kqed.org, or you can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And again, we're looking for kind of public spaces that other people ignore, but that you notice because your sport, your hobby, your art, your job. Jose, do you want to read to us a little bit from Chipped? I think this, you're going to read the last couple paragraphs of the first essay, right?
Yeah, this is kind of the title track essay called Chipped, and just kind of breaks down some of the terminology. Chipping a board is a natural part of skating. A chip is a small piece of board that breaks off around the nose or tail from the wear and tear of skateboarding. Novice or pro skaters will ride chipped boards, but when you're a kid, chipping your board is kind of a rite of passage. Without disposable income, kids ride boards until they nearly disintegrate, the grip tape all mashed up and mangled along the edges where wood used to be. Filling in the chips keeps the board going as long as possible. It's a symbol of the stubborn dedication to a deck and to a toy as skaters and as adults whose bodies will also reach their inevitable end. But the toy evolves beyond a fad and becomes something more. A compass, a lens, a portal to joy only found by trying and failing along the way. The irony is the older I get, the more I empathize with those chipped boards I had as a kid, hiding marks and blemishes while maintaining the semblance of a skater as an adult, not wanting to be discarded, wanting to still be seen as useful, functional, and skating, bruised and chipped for as long as possible.
That was Jose Body reading from his new essay collection, Chipped, Writing from a Skateboarder's Lens. You know, there's a bunch of things that brought up for me, but one of them is, I feel like skateboarding is almost as defined by the failure to do tricks or failures as it is by when people land them, right? Like, even in the documentation of the sport, people document their failures too.
For sure, you know, in order to tell the viewer like how difficult a trick is, but I think, you know, that's a big reason why a lot of skaters go and kind of do skate tourism and visit skate spots, even if they don't have a board on them, to see how difficult the obstacle is on which and kind of through which a skater executes a high-level trick, you know? Mm-hmm. How rough is the ground? How steep is the incline? Or how dry or waxed the ledges? All of that factors into the difficulty factor that's brought to life through photography and video.
That's so interesting. The other thing I was thinking about as I was listening to you read, you know, skateboarding has clearly been a big influence, and we're going to talk more about that. But you also were part of Youth Speaks in the Bay Area, right, in college. Like, do you see, I mean, it's not exactly improvisation, but there's something about the way Youth Speaks poets, like, both memorize but then have to kind of perform that strikes me a little bit like it has some connection to skateboarding.
For sure. I think there's a performative element between both the act of skateboarding, especially in a public space where other skaters may be seeing you, and being, you know, particularly a spoken word poet where you're taking words from your journal that, you know, you've edited heavily, that are not freestyled, but you're memorizing them much like a rap and presenting them as a spoken word poem. And Youth Speaks, which is a nonprofit here in San Francisco, works with 13 to 19-year-olds around literary space and education. They're based here in the Mission District, not too far from you guys here, KQED. Mm-hmm. And they really kind of gave me a stage and a platform to start figuring out how to tell stories through poetry And that enabled me to kind of understand why and start to begin to articulate how skateboarding was impacting me. So skating would make like little cameos in different poems and different stories along the writing, along my kind of trajectory as a writer. But it wasn't until Chipped where I really kind of gave myself the agency to really dive into this whole worldview. But all of that started 20 years ago, showing up to You Speaks open mics and giving it a shot and trying and failing. You know, maybe some performances don't work out the way you want to, your jokes or your deep lines don't land with the audience, but it's back to the drawing board. And that is the Sisyphus kind of comparison with skateboarding, right?
Yeah. I mean, when you started writing about skateboarding, what's so difficult to capture about the feeling of skateboarding?
Well, I think one thing is you don't want to describe it in a corny or cheesy fashion, because I think skaters are just ready to hear that. They're waiting for their culture to kind of be misrepresented, because it oftentimes is, you know, and it's this, you don't want to have like this book is not titled Cowabunga for a reason. You know what I mean? Like the way in which skateboarders are represented in mass media is very much this like radical, like I just see nothing but like neon designs and just like, and really bad photography, right? So I think was you know, it's because we care so much about this form, this culture, this physical act. We compare it to an art form because of how much we know the movement and the physicality of it. But we also relate to it as a sport, as a competitive thing. But I think it's because skateboarding is such a culture. We want it to be represented well by people who skate or are adjacent enough to the culture to know how to represent it in a respectful way.
Mm. Seems like a difficult writing task too, though, right? Because you kind of have that insider audience, but you also do want to transmit from that interior culture out to the rest of us, right, who can barely stand on a skateboard, hypothetically.
Sure, yeah, right. And some of us, even you know, as we age, are still trying to stand on our skateboards, right? So I think, like, you are starting from the interior. And I think some of the big pieces I started in this book were those kind of, like, inside baseball pieces and working your way out. I oftentimes show drafts to my wife and it's like, do you understand this? Like, do you even understand the physicality of what's happening here? Like, is up, yeah, up and down, down kind of thing, right? And, you know, just trying and failing or just trying to understand, like, how much information do I want to give the reader? Where do I want them to work and kind of fill in the blanks themselves? How much terminology and tricks do I need to break down? That was all the challenge of writing Chipped, but I think it pushed me to, you know, write for a broader audience with skateboarding while still trying to stay true to myself as a skater.
You know, because it's such an internal culture, I mean, what did your parents, for example, you seem like you were a good kid, you know, went to Berkeley, et cetera. What did they think of your skating?
It was a social contract where in order to, like, get to Cal or get into college, I basically had to get really good grades or else I couldn't go skating, I couldn't go to shows, I couldn't really do much. So, I mean, it was, you know, pay to play, so to speak. So it taught me, in addition to chores and all the, you know, rites of passage that kids have. So I think they were worried, though. I mean, this is 90s LA, and even though I grew up in the suburbs, it's still, you know, there's a lot of things going on in terms of police, in terms of power. So they're worried, but I think we built trust over time.
Yeah. We're talking with Jose Body about his new essay collection, Chipped, Writing from a Skateboarder's Lens. I want to hear about your lens. Is there a public space that people may not notice, but because of your sport, your hobby, your art, your job, you pay particular attention to it? We'd love to hear about those. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email us forum@kqed.org. We'll be back with more with Jose Body right after the break.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest, and I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
Hi there. I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Jose Vadi about his new essay collection, Chipped, Writing from a Skateboarder's Lens. I want to bring in Brian in San Francisco. Welcome, Brian.
Love it. I love this conversation.
Tell us, Brian, you know, some of your spots.
Once you said, the Safeway curb, I immediately flashback, like Sears curb, Fort Miley, back in the day when you had to run. Well, just running, period. But I don't want to suck up this conversation. But I'm just I love the fact that they're like this program is bringing my culture, our culture, forward, and it's beautiful. Yeah. So I haven't read the book yet, but I'm now going to.
Yeah, I think you're going to love it, Brian. Based on what I'm hearing. All right, thanks so much. Really, really appreciate that. You know, it is interesting. Like it kind of blows my mind how skaters do know a totally different city. You know, when he says Sears curb, like what do you hear when you think about that?
Oh, I think Javonte Turner, Masonic, and Geary. I mean, that's where the Sears Curve used to be, I believe, if I'm getting my geography here right. And it was kind of a spot that led to another spot, which is Wallenberg on Masonic, the school there, the Big Four, which is still a proving ground for skateboarders. So yeah, it immediately takes me back to late 80s, early 90s San Francisco, to that parking lot I believe was different at the time. I mean, it was the Sears. But yeah, immediately I know what generation Brian, I believe, you know, comes from and where that spot, I believe, was at. I at least have an inkling. But yeah, like Fort Miley, I mean, these are kind of
the legendary.
Legendary, absolutely spot. Yeah, absolutely legendary.
Another listener writes in front of what was once called the Bank of America building, 555 California, there is a plaza that has a huge black statue. Folks called it the Darth Vader. It was a place that people walked through without paying much attention, but I always loved that plaza. It's an open space on the corner of California and Montgomery, and you can watch the cable cars from there. Very San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So let's say someone out there is listening. Maybe I should pick up skateboarding. Is this a sport that like you essentially have to learn when you're kind of young and dumb / risk tolerant? I mean, is this like something you can pick up as a newly 42-year-old man?
Yeah, or woman, or you know, however you identify, I think you can get into it at any age. You know, there's skaters much older than me that are doing much riskier stuff. There's a lot of great nonprofits around the Bay Area that work predominantly with youth, but there's also some adult skate sessions out there, or just kind of some open, come one, come all sessions. And spots like Rockridge just kind of engender that every day. But check out Skate Like a Girl. They have a Bay Area office here that does a lot of cool programming for young folks and older folks alike. SF Skate Club here in the city is a great program for young people.
But I guess what I'm trying to say, though, Jose, is like can my body actually take it? My you know, as an older dude, will I break my wrists and my face and everything else?
Well, that assumes that's going to happen, right? You know, I feel like it's a matter of kind of trying it and testing out those risks, right? Like, how comfortable do you feel on a board and kind of taking it step by step, which is why I was citing those programs. They kind of teach you how to fall, teach you how to roll, and so you begin to understand how both are important. You need to know how to push as much as how to, you know, tumble instead of like splat on the ground kind of fall. So, you know, how to like not break your wrist every time you do a fall, how to like just kind of that, those instincts, that muscle memory that you're building. But as we saw in the pandemic, I mean, people were buying roller skates, people were buying bikes. I mean, people were seeing the benefit of slow streets. So I think the larger impact of how skateboarding fits into a community of wellness or a city built around those kind of non-car options, it also factors into that too.
I mean, how about for you? I mean, how has skating changed, you know, from when you were doing it as a teenager to, you know, doing it now?
Well, definitely, you know, from the actual acts, like I do way more low impact stuff. I'm not hooking myself downstairs or off loading docks these days. But I think it's become more important the older I've gotten, because it's so centrifugal to a worldview that I developed at such a young age that enabled me to get into all the things that I'm passionate about, including writing. You know, having something that you're passionate about and wanting to articulate it was my catalyst for becoming a writer. And that was skateboarding. So I think, you know, the act and the culture become so much more important the older you get, because you're still meeting skaters at different points in their life. And it creates this kind of intergenerational learning through skate spots and through even like online skate communities as well, where you can continue to inspire yourself, continue to push yourself, and continue to see your world, both the built environment and, you know, music and all those spaces in a different way too. Much like you kind of value a skate spot like a Fort Miley or things like, when those things go away, a part of a skater's hearts, you know, breaks. And so your favorite venue, your favorite movie theater, your favorite restaurant, are you supporting those things on a daily basis and having a consistent relationship with them to not take those things for granted? That's how I feel about skateboarding as well. If I have the physical ability to do the thing, I need to do it for those that can't, as well as my future self that probably won't be able to either, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like what you're saying is that the way we hold on to these things that make us feel alive but feel like a young person's game is to keep trying, right? Keep doing it. Can't just give up without actually, you know, going to that theater, going to the show, doing all those things.
Yeah, and even feeling old doing it. Like, it's not a portal to become young again. It's you can be 40 and skating, and that's rad. You know what I mean? Like, it feels different on your board, and that's great. You know, more power to you.
I'm going to bring in Vita in San Anselmo. Welcome, Vita.
Hi, thanks. This is a fun conversation today. And I was just wondering, what's the difference in riding a traditional skateboard versus one of those one-wheel skateboards? Can you still do the tricks on the one-wheel?
Oh, interesting. Thank you for that question, Vita. Have you tried one out, Jose, the one wheels?
I have not tried a one wheel or electric skateboard out. One literally just passed by the KQED offices right now, which is hilarious timing. So thank you for your call. That's fantastic. But yeah, I don't think you can do it because you don't have a tail necessarily. You know, the one wheels are kind of these very high tech 2x4s with a wheel sticking through the middle. And, you know, I guess you can carve and do stuff like that, but at 25 miles per hour with a remote control.
I was about to say, most people are just staying alive.
Yeah, you know, like just hold on and stay on. Yeah, just good luck. But yeah, so that's the difference there. Some electric skateboards have tails and maybe you can do tricks with it, but I have not tried.
You're not drawn to it?
No, it's not for me. But, you know, different strokes for different folks, I guess you can say.
Is that because you like the actual kind of control of pushing? Like, is that part of the flow state, is to be able to push off like that?
Oh, yeah. And you know, pushing is such an integral part to skateboarding. I mean, skaters, to get really, you know, inside baseball with it, skaters talk about how other skaters push and, you know, like the beauty of it and stuff of certain pro skaters, right? So, yeah, that's part of it. It's also just the ability to have control over your skateboard. Like, I'm not attracted to things like roller skates or snowboarding because you're like strapped in. And I feel that way even on electric skateboard, like you're kind of strapped into the velocity of it. And some, and you know, what if the thing just stops? Like, what do you do then? You know, do you, I don't know. It just worries me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I understand that, obviously. You know, these essays in this book are a bit of a love letter to analog culture of the 90s, like in particular, maybe the VHS skate video. What do you think that form captured that we're not getting, you know, necessarily through Instagram Discover, say?
Yeah, I think, well, the VHS was powerful because, you know, skate videos are self-produced, you know, things that are distributed through either mail orders or skate videos in the 90s. So, you know, very much DIY, almost like an indie rock label. Like there's, you know, maybe 1,000 pressings of a VHS. But once those things were produced and you find another kid that has two VHS decks, that kid becomes like the VHS manufacturing factory, you know what I mean? And you start creating VHS mixtapes, and much like how a lot of punk rock and underground music started through like mixtapes, cassette shares in the 80s into the 90s, so too did a lot of skate videos. And keep in mind, like you're paying maybe 15, 20 bucks as a kid for a skate video. That's like your skate video for months, you know what I mean? At a time, there's right, no social. Right, so right. These mixtapes became very, you know, intrinsic to the culture. It also speaks to this relationship between TV and VHS and the ability to document whatever's on MTV and TV into a VHS and integrate that into like this mixtape with other skate videos. So there's like, you know, which speaks to this analog time, right? There's no Discover page, kind of, thank God, but there's no, you know, Discover page at the time. And you can, you need kind of to look at magazines and radio and TV and try to capture those things through cassette or VHS and have that relationship of record and play, of trying to document things that are important to you. And kind of to the point about skate spots earlier, you're really just collecting all the things that matter to you as a skater and holding those things through these cassettes and mixtapes. Mm.
You know, it's also interesting because for me, it was really the magazines, you know, and not skate shop magazines. I was definitely more in the Thrasher level, like something in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. What do you think it was about those skate magazines that have like kind of held their grip on the culture? Like I see people who are 19 years old wearing like Thrasher t-shirts, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Thrasher magazine, born and bred here in San Francisco, California, is amazing and is kind of like the canonical print magazine for skateboarding. And I think it's because, you know, you're presenting skateboarding through still photography, and it creates this sense of wonder of how is this possible? How did this person get from point A to point B? And what does that look like? What does that feel like? And even in an era before skate videos, you can imagine how, you know, dreamy that could feel, like just seeing this image and thinking, like just being wowed by it. Thrasher, I think, really owns not just has a very strong brand narrative and brand presence, you know what I mean? Like the name alone is kind of centrifugal in skateboarding and is almost an active verb of what it means to be like, what it means to skate and be a skateboarder. But, you know, I think it also presented artwork. And in Thrasher today, there's two-page spreads every month of Mark Gonzalez's artwork. It presents bands. It shows letters to the editor and artwork from fans. It even allows fans to submit photos of them documenting other skaters and their crew. So it became, you know, the centrifugal voice of skateboarding, while by embracing the rough edges and, you know, trying to showcase kind of like a biased view of skateboarding. Like, this is what it's like in NorCal, in the Bay Area, and, you know, in probably in your community too. But I think by way of just embracing what it means to be a skateboarder and trying to showcase that on the page as much as possible, they really kind of, you know, became that trusted voice in skateboarding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, big shout out to Thrasher and everything that they do. Mm-hmm. Shows like This Old Ledge are really cool, kind of art history, urban history stories that they're doing now, way more nonfiction. So it's cool to see the ways in which magazines are embracing both print and digital to tell new forms of storytelling in skateboarding.
Yeah. We have some fun comments coming in with different public spaces. One listener writes, I remember taking my son, Stefan Janoski, to San Francisco every other weekend to skate Warrensburg, the Embarcadero, and how he loves going to see some of the pros, including Javonte Turner at the FTC skateboard shop.
Wow.
Skating for him was his life, and it turns out it's still his life as a professional skateboarder.
Yeah, Stefan Janowski is an amazing skateboarder, generational talent. Yeah, so thank you very much for calling in. There's a very cool show called Epically Latered, and there's an episode about him recently that I highly recommend. But yeah, parents supporting their kids, driving them to spots and doing day trips as their kids go and skate in Embarcadero. Thank you for supporting kids and, you know, allowing them to kind of explore and see who they are in these new spaces.
Wow, that's cool. The we've got people shouting out some fascinating public spaces too. One listener writes, growing up during the transition period from steel and clay wheels to urethane wheels, I was an early skate rat. Pools, first skate parks, Mount Baldy pipeline. I work at a large parking garage with a beautiful circular 7-story ramp. I've always envisioned riding down on my skateboard. One day I was helping a family with 2 young teen boys with skateboards and let them skate down the length of one of the closed ramps. They were stoked.
Good for you. That's awesome. I hope you didn't get in trouble. That's great, though. Man, I mean, back to one of our original points, Alexis, around, you know, this kind of Sears curbs, right? Like that transition to urethane wheels in the 70s. I mean, that's like a huge moment in skateboarding history. So,
because what does it let you do? What do urethane wheels let you do that others did not?
I mean, it kind of truly roll across surfaces. I mean, before you're on like steel wheels, you know what I mean? Like that's not holding up through like a San Francisco puddle, you know what I mean? So you need to be able to roll and different with different urethanes, and the urethane wheel was huge. So never been to Mount Baldy pipeline. I grew up next to the Inland Empire in the San Gabriel Valley, so I still need to make the trek, but awesome.
You know, one of the things that you've noted in the book, you know, is that skaters prefer skating in the real world to skate parks. Like, why is that? You'd think a skate park has been kind of designed for them.
In one sense, yes. I mean, but all the obstacles in a skate park are based off of things that originated in the streets. So it's kind of this, it's kind of like a chicken and egg scenario, right? You need the streets in order to create the skate parks, you know? I think skaters don't necessarily, going back to the conversation around Rockridge and why we love skating this parking lot, is there's a freedom in movement. You're not contained, and you can adjust the environment. You can bring in a jump ramp and take out a jump ramp. You can bring a flat bar and take out a flat bar. Whereas a skate park, particularly those that don't have community involvement with the local skate community, you're being told this is how you skateboard in this environment and with these limitations. Enjoy it or not, you know what I mean? So it's just or don't skate kind of thing. Yeah. So the more community involvement we can have with city officials and skaters to create spaces, long-term spaces for skateboarding, the better. But skaters will always explore their built environment, and you know, they will always try to find new types of, you know, terrain to skate.
Another listener, Rachel, works for a state agency that regulates shoreline development and wants to know what you think of the project they permitted, Isla Creek Skate Park on Tulare Street in San Francisco.
Oh, is that the, I believe they're referring to the ledges that are there,
yeah.
I believe. And if they are, I think that's great. I mean, I've seen a lot of skaters utilizing those spaces and spaces that would not be used in, you know, kind of productive capacities. You know, they're kind of like, they would otherwise be kind of like these dead zones, but creating more plaza spaces that can have these dual uses with skaters and pedestrians alike, I think is way better than building a new downtown plaza with nothing but skate knobs on it, which makes a skater, let alone a pedestrian, just actively not want to sit there or engage with it in any capacity whatsoever. So,
and for those who haven't thought about this, a skate knob is...
Oh, it's like a bracket that's kind of shaped in the right angle, or sometimes starfish along the Embarcadero that prevent, you know, skaters or BMXers or roller skaters from rollerbladers from grinding ledges or... But they're so actively used that it's almost like you can't even sit on a bench anymore, or you can only sit in like a 6-inch width on a public bench, you know?
You need a certain type of body.
Yeah, you know, so it's hostile in a lot of ways, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We are talking with Jose Vadi about his new essay collection, Chipped, Writing from a Skateboarder's Lens. You know, skateboarding has allowed Vadi to explore public spaces that we often ignore. And we'd love to hear about the public spaces you know that you feel other people ignore, but that you pay particular attention to because your sport, your hobby, your art, your job. Give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. The email address is forum@kqed.org. We're going to get to a bunch more calls and comments right after the break. People definitely want to talk about places they love to skate. And you can tell us yours. Again, the number 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned. For peace, no one is willing. Kinda make you get that feeling. Everybody smart. Use the peel and the dough. Educated food.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Forum. We're talking with Jose Body about his new essay collection, Chipped. Jose, I wanted to ask you about your sort of musical comparisons. One listener writes in to say, the great jazz musician Jason Moran compared skaters to a jazz ensemble. Both toss themes to each other, feed on the theme, build the energy, encourage each other. I thought it was a beautiful comparison, and I bet you do too.
Yeah, it's a cool comparison, and music, you know, is so centrifugal to skate videos that, you know, as you get into skateboarding, you have this audio visual, like this sonic relationship with skateboarding too. The act of skating itself is so loud too. It's just, you know, the sonic relationship starts early. With a jazz ensemble though, it's an interesting comparison because every time an ensemble plays live, there's different variations and iterations of known songs that you can read on sheet music and play off of sheet music, but there's known spaces where we're gonna improvise and, you know, do our own thing here, but come back to the form, you know, or the head in jazz. So I feel like same with the skate spot. A skate spot is that kind of melody that can stay constant, but the way that you interact with a curb or a ledge or a set of stairs creates this kind of improvisation, almost like a soloist approaching a track. Mm-hmm. And, you know, jazz has been used in skate videos throughout its kind of history, you know, starting.
Which is surprising to me, actually.
Yeah, you know, but it works, you know, as much as, you know, the stereotype might be like heavy metal. You know, within one skate video, you might hear everything from Slayer, A Tribe Called Quest, you know, Lee Scratch Perry, Dr. Octagon, and then Sun Ra or John Coltrane or Miles Davis, you know. So it really runs the gamut. But and I think jazz can be used in a disruptive way in skate videos, too, for the positive, where it's like, OK, you hear four hip hop tracks in a row and then hear Sun Ra coming at you. But Sun Ra was most recently used in the Supreme video, I believe, Blessed. And it was just really cool to see that, and with a big brand kind of behind it. And, you know, it kind of created this really reflective moment within the skate video that I wanted to try and talk about through this an essay whose title I can't say on air, but is in the book and is about Sun Ra.
Let's listen to a bit of Sun Ra, and then we're going to talk about why you think specifically Sun Ra is a good way of thinking about skateboarding. We'll be back. Jose, I'm totally fascinated by the idea that this would be a track in a skate video.
Yeah, or in the skate video of my mind, right?
Yeah, in the skate, like as you're skating, this is what you're hearing? This is kind of how you're thinking?
A little bit, yeah. You know, especially that the first part that we heard, the way in which Sun Ra, who plays the keys, kind of dips in and out of the melody, just kind of jumping brass notes, playing the lead melody, it has so much playfulness and so much space within the song that you kind of see yourself like hitting a curb and then pushing and then hitting another curb and kind of grooving in between different slappies across like Rock Ridge curbs. Or, you know, you can kind of see, I feel like skaters, when they hear certain songs, they think this would make a good soundtrack for a skate part or maybe even my own skate part. And I think I kind of took that to the extremes in this essay of, and also during the pandemic and just listening to Sun Ra and just so moved by his music. I couldn't go to a live show, but I can go skate the curbs and kind of almost dance with this music in my head through skating.
You know, John wants to know, nearly all skaters I have met have creative endeavors outside of skating itself, be it art, music, photography. Why do you think so many skaters seem to be creative types?
I think skaters are creative types because skateboarding is a culture, and by way of skate, even more so than maybe even a sport. We have our own film industry, we have our own photography industry, we have our own graphic designers, our own artists who, you know, our own companies that features their artwork on boards, and it just keeps inspiring and engendering new generations of skaters who understand that being a skater is one who does the act itself, but can encapsulate all these other different worlds, you know? So yeah, skateboarding is a culture, and I think by way of that, it's multidisciplinary in nature.
Do you think some of it, I mean, in one of your essays, you dedicate a lot of space to Ed Templeton, mm-hmm. the skater, as someone who kind of encouraged you to do the documentation of skateboarding. Do you think that's also part of it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, going back to the conversation around Thrasher, like without those images, you can't even imagine what the act itself looks like, right? So yeah, I mean, that was huge. And I think Ed Templeton had a column in Transworld Skateboarding called Programming Injection. And in one of the articles, he said, documentation is domination. And I thought that was so powerful. And I started taking photos pretty much immediately from there, started keeping a journal. And it kind of gave, I was already feeling like skateboarding was changing my perspectives around things and that I wanted to like share them and document them and keep stickers and keep old boards and the ephemera as much as the memories. So yeah, Ed Templeton very much gave me the agency to do so through that article. Mm-hmm. He's a visual artist and runs Toy Machine Skateboards still mm-hmm. to this day. And yeah, I think a lot of skaters, you know, once you get into skateboarding, you kind of find those skaters that you align to, both in terms of the act itself, but also, you know, everything that they represent and the communities that they help bring into skateboarding. Mm.
Let's bring in John in Berkeley. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. One of my favorite stories about skateboarding was from the early days of the pandemic, when there wasn't hardly any traffic, and somebody took it upon themselves to skate eastbound down the Bay Bridge and really captured a moment of freedom, I'm sure.
Wow. I don't remember that. Do you remember that, Jose?
Oh, man, the pandemic memories are such a blur sometimes, but I think I know what they're talking about. Yeah. There's been other moments in Bay Area history where certain bridges have been closed down and skaters have been able to like snag a photo. I think recently on the Golden Gate Bridge that happened. But yeah, it's he might be also referring to a Thrasher cover where a skater actually skated part of the Bay Bridge.
You know, Kyle writes in to say, my favorite skate spots are stairs. There are hundreds of sets of stairs in San Francisco that the average pedestrian walks up and down with the skateboarder as a trick to perform. I'd love to hear Jose pick a few of his favorites.
Oh, staircases? Interesting. Mm-hmm. There's this kind of marble set near the First Street entrance to the freeway. It used to be a Bank of America clock tower. It's the Maritime Building, excuse me. The Maritime Building has these beautiful marble stairs that always look good in photos. It's an absolute bust to skate, but looks really great in photos. There's an absolutely terrifying double set that Ernie Torres ollied in North Beach. It's kind of like in an alleyway. It's a very lesser known spot, but if anyone skates that, more power to you. Those are two that come to mind immediately. And Hubba Hideout, rest in peace, which is a six-stair kind of pedestrian bridge with ledges going down them that helped create the term hubba within skateboarding. That was also a popular smaller stair spot as well.
You know, Jose, earlier we were talking about your parents' relationship to your skating, and we just so happened to have Jose Vadi calling in from Pomona, California. Oh, welcome.
Hello.
Hey, Jose, thanks for joining us.
Well, I don't want to eat up my son's time. It's his moment. But I just simply want to say how proud I am of my son. Growing up in East Harlem in New York and being a barrio Puerto Rican, I was afraid of the impact the streets would have on my son. But I am glad that I did not crush his spirit, that I let him follow his inclinations, that I let him do what his heart dictated. And I am so proud of him today. That's really all I have to say.
Oh, Jose, thank you so much. It sounds more like your son's having an impact on the streets rather than the other way around. Thank you so much.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and I'm really glad to see the reaction of the audience to his presentation. Thank you. I won't take up more of your time. I'm most appreciative.
Thank you so much. Bye. I mean, in the book, you do talk about, you know, being unsure of how your parents would react, and also just, you know, what it might or might not mean to them that you were part of this culture.
Yeah. I think, like, children of immigrants inherit a lot of history. And I think we are oftentimes put in the position to, I don't know, like, kind of be the product of the investment, the product of the journey, you know what I mean? And I think, like, getting into an activity that puts you in direct confrontation with pedestrians and business owners and police officers and potentially other forms of power on the street, like gangs, like, you know, it's not, it doesn't really crystallize into that plan, you know, cleanly. So a lot of trust has to be developed. And that goes for not just skaters, but kids that are in the bands or kids that want to, like, be breakdancers or b-boys. You know, like, I can only imagine if I got into, like, rave culture in the 90s, what conversations I would have to have with my dad. So, you know, but it runs the gamut. And, you know, to Stefan Janowski's mother's point earlier, you got to give kids agency and you got to give kids trust. And thankfully, there's a lot more after-school programs and nonprofits that are allowing parents to kind of see that at earlier ages, too.
Yeah. You know, speaking of, you know, kind of the confrontations or the difficulties that skaters sometimes have and people around skaters, you know, one listener writes, can Jose speak to skateboard etiquette? As a San Francisco resident, I've been terrorized by skateboarders while walking as well as driving in my car. I felt like I had to jump out of the way of someone coming from behind me. Also been harassed when I safely passed them on the roadway. So how do you navigate those kind of tricky relationships with the other, you know, users of the city?
Oh yeah, you know, it's, I feel like cities are going to have that that kind of back and forth, you know, with, like, fellow bicyclists and skaters. I think this is where the e-skate, I frankly don't think that electric skateboards should be allowed in, like, bike lanes, you know what I mean? Like, that's a pretty disruptive proposition in terms of speed. But you know, I think it's just about skaters and pedestrians alike, like, you know, respecting each other's space, I think, is key. If you notice that, like, you definitely don't want to walk through the middle of a skate session as much as you don't want to walk through the middle of a busy bike lane. So, you know, just understanding, you know, that kind of relationship, I think, is key. But I think the etiquette really is just trying to share space as respectfully as possible. You know, skaters are citizens of the city as much as, you know, pedestrians are. So it's just trying to find a coexistence and a balance.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think we were all interested in on our team was just kind of skateboarding as this kind of solitary activity, but also kind of a place of community and the relationship between those two things.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you meet other skateboarders and you begin to, especially in the 90s in a pre-social media world, you know, you really get to understand, like, you get to meet your kind of fellow obsessive people, you know what I mean? And I think when you have a crew of skateboarders that you grow up with or come up with or, you know, skate with all the time, the community, you know, just kind of grows and grows. And skating is such a unique perspective, such a unique lens in terms of your relationship with space and how much you challenge your relationship with space and yourself, that you kind of have a more open idea of the ways in which you overlap with other cultures, like bands or graphic designers or, you know, like all these different subcultures are kind of Venn diagrams that overlap a lot. And skateboarding might be one of the bigger overlaps where you have a lot of different connections with other subcultures. You know, I mean, a skate video alone can show you skateboarding, but also the fashion, the independent, you know, the clothing that skate brands develop themselves. Again, being a culture, creating your own clothes, your own style. So I think that you need that community to make skateboarding possible. You know, as much as you need the pro skater, you need the pro photographer, you need the videographer documenting them. So this community of creatives creates skateboarding, and that's part of the reason. But we all found each other by way of being skateboarders, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah. Let's bring in Robert in San Leandro.
Okay, hello.
Hey, Robert, I'm a member of the skateboarding community here. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I'm Robert Ferguson, founder of the Rob Skate Academy. Not sure if you've heard of it, but we focalize on... Oh, awesome. Yeah, staff has told me to call on in, and they said that skateboarding is being like showcased right now on NPR, and so my phone has just been kind of ringing off the hook. So that's really awesome. And it's, I've been listening in just a little bit, and hearing that on like the immigration and like immigrants. So I'm first generation born here in the United States. My parents from Jamaica, and they absolutely hated me skating growing up. like during that whole era, they always just thought that I was just going to be like a druggie or, you know, just, you know, some like deadbeat. And like, truth be told, I mean, what we're doing now is just absolutely like breathtaking and just like awesome for the community. So thank you for all of what you're doing, and thank you for bringing education into the skateboarding realm and writing this book. Like,
thank you so much, Robert. And you know, it's an interesting thing, Jose. I mean, working with kids, do you imagine what they get out of skateboarding is the same thing you get out of skateboarding?
Potentially. I think I have to keep in mind just the different generations I came up in, you know, and kind of humble myself in that way. You know, I don't want to presume that by way of being a skater, I know what it's like to be a 13-year-old skater, you know, here in the city, right? But I definitely understand the love and the obsession and, you know, and the tricks and just how cool it is and how fun it is, you know? So there's that empathy that you can build in with youth immediately just by way of the thing, by way of the toy, by way of the act. And, you know, thank you, Rob, for calling in. I believe they're based in West Oakland and do adult classes for skaters too. But, you know, just that kind of each one teach one mentality of skateboarding, you know, I think is really great. And right now in the culture too, there's way more kind of intergenerational like connections, I think. Like I feel like when a spot like Rockridge is cool because the 40 to 50 year old, you know, men and women are there with the 12-year-old kid and you're sharing space. You're trying to be respectful of each other's space. There might be some teachings of like, hey, maybe not skate around in AirPods and you're gonna like run into people because you're not hearing them. But you know, those conversations kind of happen by way of skateboarding, and that's part of the community too, is teaching each other how to respect each other.
Do you have a perfect ride, like the equivalent to like the surfer's perfect wave?
Oh wow, that would be beautifully quixotic if I had one. No, I don't. Unfortunately, I think just having a good session where I go home sore but not broken. I think that is my perfect wave.
You know, Chris writes, I haven't skated in 30 years, but I still love the art. You mentioned the audio of it, and I absolutely love it. Kind of like the scene in The Big Lebowski where he's listening to bowling. I could listen to the sounds of kickflips, nose and tail grinds, dark slides, etc., and it brings me great joy. Can't wait to pick up your book. We have been talking with Jose Body about his new essay collection. It's called Chipped, Writing from a Skateboarder's Lens. The book comes out today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The 9 o'clock hour forum is produced by Grace Wan, Blanca Torres, and Dan Zoll. Our interns are Emiko Oda and Annie Burton. Marlena Jackson-Rotondo and Ashley Ng are engagement producers. Francesca Fenzi is our digital community producer. Judy Campbell's lead producer. Danny Bringer is our engineer. VP of news is Ethan Tovin-Lindsay. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with host Mina Kim. You know.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.